Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to the second in a long, long series of shows known as Press One for Democracy. Tonight, we're going to be talking about jobs, and we're going to talk about how to create jobs and getting America back to work. But before we start all that, I'd like to welcome in Debbie Lynn Molyneux, our co-host for the evening. How are you doing, Debbie Lynn?
Hey, Dan. Great to be here with you on this warm night here in Portland.
Warm night? How so?
Oh, well, earlier today, anyway, it was up in the 50s, and we had the sun shining, and I can't believe it's still February.
Very nice, very nice. I am actually broadcasting today from Punta Gorda, Florida, where it was a balmy 65 and beautiful and sunny, and I'm trying to make my stay here in Florida last as long as I can before coming back. But nice to know that while I'm gone, at least you're getting some nice weather.
Yes, lots of vitamin D, because we need it up here.
Always this time of the year. So again, this is Dan Aronson with Debbie Lynn Molyneux. You are listening to Press One for Democracy, a coffee party radio show, our second show. So welcome. We're going to be talking about jobs. No matter how it seems to slice it, it seems to always come back to jobs. We need to get the middle class back to work, and we need to get lower class people working as well. We need to stop talking about some of the silliness that's going on in Washington. Like austerity, like budget cuts, like anything that's going to take money out of the hands of lower and middle class people, because that's just going to stagnate the economy even farther. And that's what we're going to be talking about this evening. But before we get started, let me remind everybody that the Coffee Party has a series of radio shows that includes The Middle Ground, hosted by Coffee Party co-founder Eric Feiler and Michael Charney. And that airs on Tuesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. We also have Lunch with Loudon with Janine Loudon, usually and almost always co-hosted by my co-host tonight, Debbie Lynn Molyneux. And that's at Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 p.m. Pacific Time. And finally, we have Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis, one of my favorite coffee party shows, where Egberto will usually get 6, 7, 8 people with open microphones and a nice round table going, intelligent and not just bipartisan, but transpartisan chat, the way it's meant to be on Coffee Party Radio. And that's Saturdays from 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Central, where Egberto does his thing from Texas. And all great shows and all promoting the Coffee Party principles, which is this show follows to the T, which is we want to be fact-based, we want to be civil, and we want transpartisanship, which means all parties and all viewpoints are welcome to air their opinion as long, again, as they're courteous and as long as they are excuse me, fact-based. So welcome again, and we've got a couple of callers in queue. We'll be coming to you 541 very soon. But again, just to set the stage, I want to review a little bit about what's happened since 2009, since the initial inauguration of President Obama. And when I say this, by means, I am in no way, shape, or form blaming the president for our current situation. The mess he inherited, we know, is going on long, long before. As far as I'm concerned, it goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan and the start of what we call trickle-down economics. But just to let you know how things have gone since 2009, since the president inherited this maelstrom, you're looking at a situation where 1.6 million Americans have become underemployed, okay? So we have the 8% unemployment to begin with, and now we have these 1.6 million Americans that are underemployed. So what does that mean? What that means is they left mid-wage earning jobs, and they were forced to take low income jobs, right? And the resulting pay of the, when you total and conglomerate those 1.6 million Americans, is a loss of $15.8 billion in wages. So it's no wonder that people are struggling, trying to make ends meet, trying to pay their mortgages, trying to put food on their table, trying to put their kids through college, trying to do the things that kind of before 2008 we all took for granted, because things were going really well, right? But then in 2008, we had this crash thing happen, and, you know, things went south for a lot of people. So what we're going to look at is the recovery. What have they tried to do to incent new job creation, and has it worked? If it hasn't worked, what can we do today moving forward that's going to put middle-class America back to work, not in lower-class jobs, but in middle-class jobs? So, D.L., why don't we go ahead and bring in our first caller?
Great. We'd love to do that. So, caller from area code 541, which I think is Southern Oregon. You're on Press 1 for Democracy. And can you tell us who you are and where you're calling from, please?
Yeah, my name is Josh. I'm calling from Klamath Falls, Oregon.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh.
Josh, can you help? I'm a newbie. I've lived in Portland for a year and a half. So where exactly is Klamath Falls?
We're about 4 hours heading towards the California border from Eugene, Oregon. California, Doris, California, McDowell, they're about all anywhere from 10 miles from where I am.
Okay. I can only imagine it's totally beautiful there.
Oh, yeah, right now we're cold and little snow here and there, but yeah, it's beautiful. Farming community, lots of hay, lots of cows, dairies all over. You know, my industry, I'm in asphalt, so I mean, it's not a very, it's a high demand some years. This last 2 years has been real slow. Basically, we supply asphalt products for the county and the state here, as well as California, Nevada area. What I've been in farming, though, since I was 15 years old and kind of bounced back and forth, so down here. And, you know, a lot of what I see, you know, you want a bolt, you want a nut, you go, you know, buy just about anything nowadays, and nothing is made in the U.S. of A., nothing. You know, and you look at Detroit. Now, Detroit, they used to build cars, and that was a prominent area, you know, and then over the years, like you said, the trickle-down effect. Same here, you know, and if you want to get America back to work, let's, instead of outsourcing all of our resources overseas, let's use them here and make our own products like we used to, and half the time they're better.
So while we get high-quality products, though, let me ask you this question. How do we overcome the competitive advantage that somebody like, say, a China has where they're putting people to work making those same nuts and bolts that are making one quarter or maybe one-tenth of what the American worker is making? How do we level that playing field, Josh?
Well, we have everything here. We need to do it. We send everything. In fact, I got a buddy of mine who worked on the refinery boats up in Portland, Oregon. They would take the same fuel that they loaded up at the dock in Portland, Oregon, take it 20 miles out to sea, then it'd be international waters. They'd sit out there for a week, and they'd turn around and bring it back to that same port and sell it for double what they paid for it because now it's exported, imported fuel. Now, how is that right? You're going to take fuel that you just put on a big refine boat right there in Portland, Oregon. You're going to fill it up. You're going to take it out to sea 20 miles, sit for a week, and then bring it back, and you're going to resell it for twice what you paid. And it didn't even go to China. It didn't go, you know, to Indonesia or anywhere. It went 20 miles out to sea, turned around, came back, and they resold it for twice what they paid. I mean, where's the help in that? I mean, okay, so then everybody's paying more fuel, but we didn't import it. It was ours to begin with. I mean, things like that, you know, same with these countries that have, like Nike, you know, they outsource a lot of their work. And you know, like these nuts, bolt factories, car factories. Well, thing is, it's time for America to stand up and say, look, we've got what we need here to build this stuff ourselves, to put America back to work. So if your company is outsourced, then we're not buying it. Let's say, well, look, we can make our own product, put America back to work, and not have to say, you know, just put our foot down and say, look, we're not going to deal with it no more. We don't get no profit off of it. You got bigwigs that have been sitting up in the government in the office for X amount of years. They profit off of it. They see the money from it. We don't. All we do is we buy it at the store, and, you know, we pay a tax on it that's secretly hidden in there, which is more money going to that bureaucratic guy's pocket, and we're all hungry. We're working two-day jobs. Go ahead.
So, Justin, I'm with you. First of all, I love your passion. It's a wonderful idea and it's a wonderful sentiment. But here's the reality of the situation. Now, if you can figure out how to make that happen, what you just described happen, man, more power to you. But the fact of the matter is that the number one retailer in the world and the number one global Fortune 500 company in the world is Walmart. And Walmart has one very simple business principle. They're driven by a single principle, and that is always have the lowest prices. And if you start bringing those jobs back to America and you start bringing them manufacturing, it's great. You're putting people to work. But are the Walmart people really going to say, you know what, I'm done shopping at Walmart. I'm only going to buy U.S., and if I have to pay 15 or 20 or 30% or 50% more for it, then I'm going to? Do you think people are ready to make that kind of commitment in the United States today?
Not right now, because right now all these people are out of work, and the people who are working, they're struggling just as bad as the people who aren't working. So, but I tell you what, if these people got on their feet, we had a structure where we could go and we could manufacture our own products, use our own cotton, use our own wheat, make our own products like we used to, because we never had this problem before. Okay, you look at it 20 years ago, where was everything made? Anything nowadays that's made... I went and I bought one thing, and it was Danner boots, and it was made in Portland, Oregon. It says made in USA.
Now, Josh and Dan, I want to point out to both of you that Walmart, when they first started, their stores specialized in being made. Everything in their store was made in the USA. That's how they started, in case y'all have forgotten that.
Yeah, I remember that. Now you go look at Walmart.
Now you can't find anything that's made in the USA. No, I just wanted to push that point back in. And I have a story about my mother and Walmart in a minute, so come on back to me when you're done.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. So you see, Josh, in the end, we're chasing our own tails, right? If the economy goes bad, we don't want to give up. We don't want to sacrifice our way of life. We want these same kinds of goods and services, but now we're just willing to pay for maybe a little bit more inferior goods and services, or in this case, more imported goods and services that are made with cheap labor, in some case, sweatshop kind of labor, and they're coming back into this country at a fraction of the cost. So I see what you're saying, but it's kind of like chicken and the egg, isn't it? It's like we need to get America back to work so that they'll have more money, so that they're willing to pay for higher priced products, premium-based price products that are made in the United States, but how do we have to get people back to work first. So how do we make that happen?
Well, and you know, a big portion of it is, you know, this, I working on farms, you know, even in strawberry fields, okay, I was the only, maybe there was two other white guys, three out of a handful of a crew of 50, all right, and they always say the farmer, and it ain't because they pay the Mexican guy less money. He's making the same amount as we are. They say white people don't want to do that kind of work. Well, I tell you what, I guarantee you there's a lot of white people that want to go do that work. Problem is those positions are filled, and they're filled by minorities who are illegal immigrants. That's the other thing. You've got to reform these guys, okay? If you don't have a green card, your visa's up, then you need to go home. You need to go home and let people who need that job get that job. I'm not saying that they don't need that job. I'm just saying that we've got to, you know, instead of saying, okay, let's amnesty these people, no, if you're not supposed to, or your visa's up, you don't have a green card, let's go and send them home, and let's let the people who are not working get back on their feet. Yeah, okay, so the job only pays $8, $9 an hour. It's still a job, and there's lots of people down here that would rather go do that job than stand in the soup kitchen line or get food stamps at the welfare office.
It sounds like your solution is really demand side. So we want to create demand for American products, and we want to create demand for American workers on the job. And that's the solution, is to control the demand side and not the supply side.
When you got a lot of you've got a handful of people here in this country that are doing jobs that their visas are up, they're supposed to go home. They're filling that position. Yeah, they're paying taxes. They're making money and they're supporting their family. But half that money they're sending home, and it's going back to another country, and it's not staying in this country. And I'm fine with that. But if you're here, you should be here legally, not illegally. All you're doing is you're making a problem for the people who could go out and not be on unemployment, not be on welfare, they could go out and they could have that job. But they don't know it because the farmer isn't going to report his workers to INS. They're not. He's not going to because they're good workers. He's not going to complain. And it's not that he's paying them less. It's just that there's no information out there, you know, that people can go and do these jobs. But not only that, there's no room for them. We've got to get this country back to where if your visas run out, if you don't have a green card, we're not giving you amnesty. You need to go home. You go home. You come back the right way.
Well,
you can stay.
Josh, you know, that also gets into a whole other foreign policy issue, which we're not talking about tonight, which means that people have a way of making a living where they're coming from, so that because the only reason they're here is because there's no jobs for them at home. You know, they don't want to travel thousands of miles away from their families so that they can – they don't do that lightly, is what I'm saying.
No, they don't do it lightly, but I mean the thing is –
And that's a whole other foreign policy issue.
Yeah,
and I didn't mean to bring up foreign policy, but I mean on the thing of it is there's so many jobs out there. I mean I heard a couple guys the other day saying, I can't find a job. I have my one job, and I found two just last week. The other thing is it's not that hard. People – just, you know, it's you get on unemployment, I've been there myself, and you get lazy. And then you wait until your job calls you back because you're getting money, not much, but you're getting money. And really, in all aspects, you're going to make more going to work. And a lot
I still think that in the 60s when they decided that welfare, it was cheaper to send out welfare checks just to send them out than it was to require people to show up and do work to earn money, which was how we rebuilt infrastructure in this country in the 1930s. Back in the 1930s, we had all the infrastructure projects, and if people wanted to earn money, the government put everybody to work, and we built all these fabulous roads and bridges, and everybody had a job, and they got paid for it, and look at what we have for the country. But somewhere in the 60s, we decided that it was cheaper to actually just send out the checks and not require any work. And it did two things. Number one, we didn't get any infrastructure built. And number two, people lost dignity because they just sit around on their asses all day and collect a check. And there's no dignity
nowadays, in that. Yeah, there's no dignity. And nowadays, you've got more fun stuff to sit at home. You got the internet. You can play games.
Yeah.
And Farmville. And, so why not? You know,
so there's,
why not?
You know, so we're getting some comments here in the chat room. I got some stuff on Facebook I want to throw in, and callers, if you guys want to come in and add to the show, I want to invite you to call in at 646-929-2495 because we have the lines are open and we're ready to take your call. 646-929-2495.
We're having fun, Josh. Really, I appreciate you calling in and giving us your ideas. That's exactly what this show is about. No idea is too outrageous. No idea is wrong. This is a brainstorming session on how we put America back to work. It is, as far as I'm concerned, the number one topic of the day. Yes, gun control is important. Yes, global warming is important. Yes, all those other things are important. But we must get America back to work or we are going, we're circling the drain. And I've never actually considered myself a pessimist or a doomsday kind of guy, but it is not looking good, folks, and we've got to get people back to work. And let's face it, I mean, here's my pet peeve on the whole subject, and that is 30 years ago, we were introduced to this concept called trickle-down economics. We've tilted the playing field so that the rich and big business could make money, and in return, they were supposed to let that wealth trickle down. Businesses were going to grow. Opportunities were going to boom. There'd be more room for startups to serve the larger businesses, and there'd be expanded job opportunities. But what's happened? What they did is they took all that money and they put it in cash and they stuck it inside Cayman Island banks and offshore accounts, and they outsourced jobs, and they did absolutely none of what they said they would do. So we have to figure out how to reverse this trend and how to create jobs here in America, create industries in America, get back to innovating, which is what we do best. And I need to know how to do it, and I need you guys to call in and tell me how to do it. So as Debbie Lynn said, the number here, 646-928-2495. When you call in, hit 1. You'll be placed into the caller queue, and we will get you on the air. As I see, we have a call from 818, Debbie Lynn.
So 818, we're going to open up your mic. Let us know who you are and where you're calling from. And your mic is live.
Hey, this is Lawrence from Los Angeles. How are you guys doing?
Good, Lawrence. How's things in Lara Land?
It's the land of the crazies. What can I tell you?
Yeah, where the weather's always perfect.
It's been a little colder lately, though, getting down in the 40s. We're not used to that.
Ooh. Hey, what part of L.A. are you in?
Out in the valley in Studio City.
Oh, nice. Nice. I have an uncle in Calabasas. He's been out there hanging out. It is beautiful. So,
yeah,
tell you what.
I have an uncle out there as well.
Do we have the same uncle? No. All right. Well, tell us how we can get the middle class back to work. I am all ears because we need to get this done.
Well, I think, and I just want to say this before I make any statements, that I am not affiliated with any political party. I'm a political atheist. I feel that we don't have a two-party system in this country anymore. You know, they create this illusion, Democrat, Republican, to give individuals a choice and divide people on social issues. Yet when it comes down to brass tacks and what really matters, monetary policy, foreign policy, war policy, they all get right in line. So I'm an independent, and I'm not a partisan person at all. But as far as the middle class goes, I think it's quite clear government does not create jobs and should not be creating jobs. We've gone from a country in the 80s where in the 80s we were the largest creditor nation to today we're the largest debtor nation. And the reason being is we went from being a country that produced items and manufactured goods to a country that just consumes goods built or made in other countries. Now, you could blame it on NAFTA. You could blame it on a whole array of topics and policies. I think what it really comes down to is our monetary policy, and I'm not one of those – I'm not trying to bash the Fed, but our system could be set up much better than the way it is right now, where they continue to just print money with all these QE. I believe right now they're doing $85 billion a month to purchase these MBSs, mortgage-backed securities. So what's really affecting the middle class, in my opinion, is them robbing each and every American blind by just debasing the currency and making the value of your dollar worth less.
Okay, so we've got, if I understand what you're saying, we've got the Fed basically feeding money into the banking system, basically at zero interest, which allows them to turn around and loan it out to anybody who wants it. Right? Well, almost devoid of, well, at least we know before the crash, it was like you didn't even have to have it. You had to have a pulse. That's all. You didn't have to have a credit rating. You had to have a pulse to get a loan, right? So these guys go in and loan out this money so that they can make money. The banks are making billions. Wall Street is fat as can be. And so what we need to do is to have the Fed stop giving them money so that squeezes down the credit, raises interest rates. How does that get Americans back to work?
The issue here is that we should be in a capitalist society and let capitalism work. When you have an entity or the government picks winners and losers, and I'm not just talking about bailouts here, when you give, let's say, the Fed, okay, a private entity, the right to coin our money, which is unconstitutional, well, they have a monopoly now, and they create money out of thin air. And I'm sure you're familiar with the fractional banking and just having 10% on reserves. But let's not forget what caused the Great Depression and what FDR in 1933 put in place, the Glass-Steagall Act, which was repealed in the early 90s. And it led to all these, obviously, NEGAM loans, and if you have a pulse, you could, or you fog up a mirror, you can own a home. It's a right to own a home, not the American dream, blah, 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 blah. So we saw the bankers do this in the past. We put regulations in place. Then they repealed those regulations, and we saw it happen again. So you're right when you say that the bankers and these big bankers, they are making billions, if not trillions of dollars. But as far as how you could get a strong middle class, it's how we had it in the past, where you have a sound monetary policy, but money becomes a tool of the people as opposed to individuals being enslaved and indebted to all these different credit card companies and banks that are out there.
So Lawrence, I am so right there with you. And by the way, 724, you're in the queue. I see you. We're coming to you next. Lawrence, I'm so right there with you. I think you're absolutely have hit on one of the definite problems that we have in our economy. But remember that tonight's show, and I agree with you, is specifically about how do we get America back to work. We, you know, unemployment figures came out. They're up again. They're now pointing right back towards that 8%. They never went below 7.5% in the whole time. We've had the hoopla of the election and everybody excited, and, oh, it went below 8%. It's going right back up to 8%. You've got millennials that are at 13% that are coming out of college, and they're strapped with student loans. They can't pay them back, so we now got this second credit bubble. But how are we going to create – how is what you're saying – just help me. Just point – I'm not disagreeing with you, but get me from point A to point B. How does toughening up back on banking regulations and squeezing down and getting a little tougher monetary policy, how does that get Americans back to work? How is that creating new good jobs?
Well, what you need is you need the government, excuse me for being blunt here, but to get the hell out of the way. That's the problem, okay?
How do you mean?
For instance, in California, in Los Angeles, there's tons of film companies that are leaving California, that are leaving L.A. They're not filming here because everywhere they turn, there's a new permit that they have to, or a new fee that they have to pay for. They drive businesses out, and at the federal level, all the government regulations, okay, you want to start a manufacturing plant or, you know, what have you, you have the EPA up your butt. You have all these different agencies and bureaucrats. You have to go through and jump through all these hoops to try and create something. Let's start with something like Obamacare. If you want to talk about something that, let's say, I don't want to say kills jobs, but at least reduces the amount of hours, employers aren't going to be affected by it. The employees are affected by it. Why? They're cutting back. I know Wendy's cut back. I think they released about 3,000 workers down to 28 hours because if they're under, I believe, 29 or 30 hours, they don't have to give them health coverage, health insurance. And as far as I just want to say the number rates, the unemployment rates, they manipulate those numbers left and right. Let's not forget they changed the criteria of what it meant to be unemployed. Before, they never calculated in there, why did we get the drop? Because they started calculating part-time jobs as full-time employment. They never used to calculate that prior to that. But as far as how, if you're sitting here and saying, how do you create jobs? It's very simple. First of all, it's very tough. When they decrease the money supply, which is where we're at, because the Fed does create recessions, depressions, or bubbles, okay, because they make money plentiful. There's a lot circulating. They're creating bubbles, whether it's in the housing market, the dot-com, what have you, the stock market bubble, wherever it gets directed. But there's a lot of capital that's flowing through society. Now, when they tighten up the money supply, they stop lending, there's not as many dollars circulating, okay? They don't issue credit. Obviously, we have this whole digital currency as well now. But they limit the actual currency supply, so there's fewer dollars out there for people.
Wait. Lawrence, I'm sorry. Let me stop here for a second. Who is limiting the currency supply?
Well,
the currency supply is created by the Fed, and the Fed has been dumping currency by the Pacific Ocean's full into the economy. In the meantime, since the crash of 08, and since well before the crash of 08, every single quarter, save three, corporate profits have gone up, skyrocketed. The corporations aren't hurting. Where are the jobs? This is the argument. This is the whole Mitt Romney job creator thing that killed me. Because I wanted to believe in the guy, and I want to believe in private industry, and I want to believe that they'll actually be somewhat benevolent. But the fact is they're making more money than they've ever made before, quarter over quarter, and still there are no jobs. Why is it if we deregulate and make it even easier for them and make them more money, why all of it, what, they just haven't made enough money to create jobs?
Well, no.
I
want to be clear that when the Fed steps in, if they give a bailout to these banks like they did, let's say when we had TARP, okay, $700 billion, you know, let's say it's a $1 trillion bailout. That really, in essence, is a $10 trillion bailout because they get the trillion and they can create $9 trillion in deposits. But that money is not going to the Bureau of Engraving, or excuse me, that bond is being purchased by the Treasury Department, by the Fed, it's not, they're not printing up $10 trillion in currency. It's a digital number that's credited into their bank, into their account.
I understand that, but you're saying, but Lawrence, here's all I'm saying. You're saying let government shouldn't create jobs. Government shouldn't be in the business of creating jobs. They need to get out of the way and let private industry do their thing. And all I'm asking you is, if private industry is making more money year over year, quarter over quarter, and the profits are going through the ceiling, and we know they're sitting on piles of cash because the tax code says it's okay to sit on piles of cash and we won't even tax you. We know it's okay to expatriate money expatriate money and not pay taxes on it only when you're repatriating, and they're doing all of these things. Why aren't they creating jobs? Why aren't they creating jobs?
Laura, I'm going to jump in here because I think they're creating jobs in other countries
because
we've made that really nice and easy. But but I want to, you know, so you guys can go on with that one if you want. But we need to talk about creating jobs in this country.
Look at the types of jobs that are – what types of jobs are being created or have been created by all these government programs?
Virtually none. They dump money into industries that have failed, into companies that have failed. Oh, I am not defending the current administration's policy on job creation. Believe me, I've got the stats. And believe me, they have taken $15.8 billion a year out of working people's wages per year over the past 4 years. Believe me, I'm not a fan. That's why I'm trying to ask you, how do we do it?
I'll give you a very simple point, a few things that can be done. One, get rid of minimum wage. Get rid of it. What that does, if I'm a business owner, no, you're going to laugh, but I'll tell you what. It's supposed to protect, but it actually keeps people impoverished, and I'll tell you why. If let's say minimum wage is $8 or $9, whatever it is, wherever you're at, okay? Let's just say it's $8. If I start a company, and someone doesn't have a skill set that is worth $8, but he has a skill set, let's say, in my mind, that is valued that I can pay him $5 for, but also I can afford to hire someone at $5 an hour, but at $8 an hour, I can't. Now, what does that do?
I got to stop you right here because my tax dollars are already supporting the people that work at Walmart because they're part-time and they have to live on food stamps and they're getting paid minimum wage. I can only imagine what Walmart is going to do with getting rid of minimum wage. I can only imagine how much more of my tax dollars are going to be going to support Walmart. Seriously.
Well, no. There are plenty of individuals that aren't working at all. Forget part-time. Forget working at Walmart.
You're saying there's the additional – if there's additional supply of labor, which there is – and won't, if you reduce minimum wage, aren't the capitalists just going to say, I can now hire cheaper and go lower because there's more, I mean, that's simple supply and demand, isn't it?
No, but you let a free market work, and understand, I don't believe in a welfare state, okay? I don't believe in that. I don't believe in all the entitlements that we're handing out. I personally don't believe in food stamps. I don't believe in, you know, the safety net, if you want to call it that, for people to abuse.
You do realize, Lawrence, you do realize that 80% of all Walmart employees get government help, get some form of welfare. 80%.
If it's there, people are going to use it. They're going to abuse it. That's it. But if it's not there, people will start being responsible and taking care of themselves.
How many people do you know, do you have in your circle of friends that work at Walmart? How many?
None.
So how do you know personally that any of these people are abusing the system and are not just people who are impoverished, who are doing the best they can and the best job they can find was at Walmart?
Again, I'm not debating. We're going to have individuals in this country that are poor. There's going to be a poor class, okay?
Yeah.
Not everyone's going to be – there's no equality here, okay? Everyone has an opportunity, but there's always going to be poor people. My point is I don't think your tax dollars – that you should be taxed, and it should go to the federal government, and they should redistribute it to individuals who they think are needy. And while going through all these different bureaucratic channels, and God knows how much or a very small percentage of the money that's actually there, actually trickles back to the people that need it. I'd rather you give out of the kindness of your own heart and have there be private institutions that take care of charity. You know, they're private
charities.
That's
a very, you know, Lawrence, that's a very libertarian viewpoint. And I wish that that really worked, that people were that generous in and of themselves. And my experience of people is that they are not. And that's why, as broken as our system is, I support it rather than supporting the generosity of humanity.
I got to say, Lawrence, I understand your arguments, and I agree with your argument, is that there are people that are abusing the system, but why are you only looking at the people on the bottom that are abusing the system, and you're giving the people, the wealthy people that have abused the system for years and years to their personal gain, you're giving them a pass for abusing the system, and you're saying you're dumping on the poor people.
No.
I really wish you would say that we at least need to be throwing some of these Wall Street guys in jail and going after some of these people criminally and civilly to get back some of the money and give it back to the middle class people that they steal from on every day. I just wish I heard a little bit of that too.
I'm with you on that. Okay, first of all, the Fed is a big Ponzi scheme. Okay, these individuals that run these major corporations and have all this corporate fraud, of course they should. You know, we just had the LIBOR scandal, all right, where they were manipulating interest rates. Who the hell went to jail for that? Nobody.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree. Corzine. Corzine. Nothing happened, and he got a slap on the hand. I'm with you on this. I'm not defending these individuals, but what I, you know, if you have a system out there, and whether it be okay because of the tax code, or how they have their income, it's going to be, or their taxes income, it's not capital gains, whatever it may be, they're working the system that is there. You want to close those tax loopholes? I'm with you. I'm right there with you. If someone breaks the law, they should be thrown to jail, and the books should be thrown at them. But when I don't individual,
I'm sorry. I hear you absolutely. We'll put you down for the idea of let government get out of the way, let capitalism and markets work, and we'll put that down for your idea as to how we get back to business.
Why
would
how does minimum wage
and toughening monetary and toughening monetary policy.
That's why I would say, how does minimum wage create jobs, or if people are still impoverished on minimum wage?
Well, it gets people off the government dole and onto a private sector dole, and make sure that it's a minimum wage. It's supposed to give you some semblance of a living wage, and that's kind of the idea. So I do appreciate your calling in here, but we do have other callers. I want to get to 575. Looks like we lost somebody, but Debbie Lynn, why don't we welcome in the 575 caller at this point?
Yeah, I want to invite Greg to call back if he's still with us somewhere. So 575, you're on Press 1 for Democracy. Who are you and where are you calling from?
This is Tamara. You caught me just in time. I was going to hang up because I called just as sort of a reaction about this Walmart thing and minimum wage. I wanted to say, just make a quick point that actually I understand both sides of the argument, getting rid of minimum wage and keeping it. But about Walmart, I wanted to say that so much of the rhetoric is the, you know, individuals will always be poor, and the focus goes to people one by one, when the reality is you have the social responsibility that I think, well, since Walmart started, I never went there. People said to me, oh, it's cheaper, you'll save money, and for years said, no, the cost will be too high. You know, mom and pop stores, the cost will be too high to our society. The only jobs people will be able to get will be at Walmart. And then Walmart will dictate what products we get and how much people get paid and on and on. Well, you know, I was kind of a real minority. As you can see, Walmart's taken over. And yet still people are blaming the employees. Well, they have to go on the till, you know, they shouldn't work there. And you were right. A lot of people don't have a choice. That's the only job in their little town. And so I want to say the social responsibility has always been there. People ignored it because they wanted to save money. And now they're turning on the very people that are suffering, and those people too want to save money, I'm sure. I mean, it was most people that wanted to save money and didn't want to say no, you know, we're going to support our local businesses and we're going to support our neighbors. They didn't do that. And so that's all I can say, because I get real hot about it.
Tamara, I cannot agree with you more. First of all, my wife was an early adopter of exactly your philosophies. I am absolutely forbidden, as is my son, forbidden to ever step in that store. And again, and you know, the fact of the matter is that, and Joseph Stiglitz writes about this in his book, The Price of Inequality, which is quickly becoming my Bible on economics and everything that's wrong with the world right now, or at least in the United States. And he talks about the fact that when Sam Walton died, his six heirs controlled 20% of the wealth in this country.
Wow.
Wow. And yet they can't seem to find it in their hearts. And I'm all for what Lawrence was saying about it's great if people are benevolent. I mean, yeah. I have a saying, and I got to say, I got to take credit for it, right? It's really simple. Capitalism without conscience is the greatest form of tyranny. Capitalism with conscience is the greatest expression of humanity. And wouldn't it be great if all of the Waltons of the world would go, you know what, yes, we're going to pay you a living wage, and no, we're not going to play games by only hiring you 39 hours a week so that you're a part-time employee, so I don't have to pay for your health care because the law says I don't. And if they wouldn't play all these games, wouldn't that be a great world?
Well, see, that's another thing that gets me upset. I mean, I've owned businesses, and I always treated my employees well. Above minimum wage, I'd pay them before me when times were hard. And that's the way I think capitalism works. You see your employees as part of the team and their neighbors and their, you know. So I agree with what you're saying, and we lost that when we started going to the Walmart mentality, I guess.
Debbie Lynn, you've had a story about your mom in Walmart, and I've been dying to hear it, so maybe this is a good time.
Yeah, well, and Tamara just brought it up, and you guys are actually speaking around it. You know, my mom is, you know, upper middle class, and she lives in Colorado in a really conservative community, and she loves Walmart because she actually feels she gains self-esteem for herself by saving money. It's one of the, you know, one of the ways that a lot of people feel good about themselves is by saving money. So when she shops at Walmart, she saves money and she feels good. And yet she doesn't understand the other side of it, that by shopping at Walmart, that people are on minimum wage, and she actually supporting that through taxation, which she also hates taxes. And I was really touched at Christmas time, and again when I was just out there a couple of weeks ago, that while I'm with her, because she knows of my political objections to Walmart, she won't shop at Walmart when I'm with her. So when I'm the 2 weeks that I was visiting, she doesn't shop at Walmart, and I'm touched by that because we have that understanding. But I mean, there's just that marketing thing that we have to deal with, and not just with Walmart, but with all the big box stores that like to sell us stuff for really cheap prices, so we feel good that we're saving money. But we don't understand the other financial implications of how that impacts jobs in this country, and how people can only – how they only then pay their workers minimum wages, and how that starts that downward spiral so that we have an economy that's at the brink and people don't have jobs.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I one of my very earliest on blogs on the economy was laid out a hypothetical story of a guy who was his work was in trouble because they couldn't compete anymore, so they lowered prices and they said, look, we can either fire people, or we can just everybody can take a pay cut, so everybody take a pay cut so everybody could stay working. And then they didn't have as much money, so instead of shopping at the local stores, they started going to the Walmarts and the Home Depots and the superstores. And then because they didn't want to sacrifice, they said, look, I can have the same lifestyle. And then all of a sudden, you know, that drives the suppliers who are supplying Walmart and Home Depot, their prices go down because they have to be competitive. And before you know it, it's a big circle and it comes back, and all of a sudden the guy's job's been outsourced. He outsourced himself because he wanted to have everything he had at a less price. And eventually he just outsources himself, and now his job is outsourced, and now he's out of a job. People don't get that connection, and it kills me sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Kills me. So Tamara, I'm so glad you get that. And I wish you could teach a course to all the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies that are making so much money that can't seem to find it in their heart, you know, to pay their CEOs less than 500 times what their average employee is making, which is about what they're paying them.
Yeah. Well, thank you, guys, for the show. I'm enjoying it. I listened to your first one earlier today. It was really good. So,
I'm glad you enjoyed that.
Yeah, I'll be tuning in. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Tamara. That's awesome. Boy, that's what, how do we breed more business owners like Tamara? That would be phenomenal.
Yeah, well, she reminds me of Janine as well, you know, that I co-host with on Thursdays, and that Janine says the same thing, you know. She figured out what she needed to do to be a responsible business owner and provide health insurance and everything, and that was great. And actually, when I co-owned a business with my ex-husband, we did the same thing. We actually provided all of that to our employees as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Coming up in the world, in the business world, in the era I did, I did a lot of studying of the Japanese culture, and that's really the way the Japanese built their post-war economy. Is that they're all about the teams. There's the one thing in writing that you'll almost never see in a Japanese business letter or any correspondence is the word I. It's always we. It's always the team. And they work hard and they play hard but they're always together. And it's like a family. And they actually care about their employees. It's amazing. It's not just, hey, 5 o'clock the bell rings and I go back to my house, you go back to your house, and I don't even know who you are. When I see you in a bar later that evening, it's like, I don't even know you. It's a sense of community, and you know it's such a wonderful thing that I love about the coffee party, right? That's our mission statement, right? Connecting communities, connecting our communities, so that we can retake, you know, our government for the benefit of the people, and that's what it's really about. So,
but, you know, the one thing that we haven't talked about here is you know we're talking about we, but a lot of the ways that we're going to be doing job creation is through small businesses and through people being entrepreneurial.
Absolutely, as long as there's capital around and people are able to get the necessary financing, because as you know, as any of us have been in the business world for a while have been, you know that 80% of all small businesses fail because they're undercapitalized. So to me, you know, that's step one, is just step one, getting in the capital. I think the other thing that the government could really do effectively is they could leverage the knowledge of successful business people that are retired, and they could go way more into consulting. I can't stand the fact that the SBA will write you a check for $1 million and say, here, good luck, and they walk away. That's not good for me. It's not good for me, the taxpayer. That's a poor investment. Wait a second. No, go back there. Help that guy. Make sure he's doing the right thing. Does he have accounting help? Mm-hmm. Does he know what he's doing in finance? Does he understand cash flow management? Help him with that. We've got all the resources. Help him. Don't just walk away and then wonder why Salinger goes out of business a year later. Don't write him a big fat check and then walk away. And that's what we do in this country, that we finally say, oh, look, we're going to help businesses. We can write them checks. Now, come on, that can't be the answer. Where's the accountability? Where's the good investment in that? There isn't any. So monumental changes we need to see in our government, and then we could really do phenomenal things. But I pontificate. So while we have a short break here, we're 50 minutes into the show. We're having a great time. This is Press One for Democracy. My name is Dan Aronson, your host, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, my co-host. And I just want to remind you a couple of things. Let's talk really quickly about the other Coffee Party radio shows we have. We've got The Middle Ground with Eric Beiler and Michael Charney, a show that I rarely miss, if ever, and it certainly is not my fault if I do, because it's a beautiful show that really it embodies the whole idea of transpartisan. You've got Michael Charney, who's a moderate Republican, Eric Beiler, who comes usually from the more left-leaning side, and it's the way they can talk about things and disagree and agree to disagree. It's a beautiful thing. It's really everything that the Coffee Party is all about. That's Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. on Pacific Time. And then on Thursdays, you've got Lunch with Loudon, 12 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. A great show, always. And then you have Politics Done Right on Saturdays with Egberto Willis, your host, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time. And then, of course, you have us, Press 1 for Democracy, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Pacific Time every Monday. So this is Coffee Party Radio. And one last little note, we are self-funded, Coffee Party USA. So if you like what you're hearing, or if you like the direction of the party, or if you want to get involved at a higher level, I seriously suggest you go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and click on Join and become a member. You can do it either by a small donation on a monthly basis or a one-time annual fee, or you can do both. Fine with me. Is that okay with you, Debbie Lynn?
Yeah, that'd be great. Rhett, I've made a post, a comment that said we need some sparks here, and Rhett on the chat says we need to be taken out and shot, so I just wanted to say bang.
You and I need to be taken out and shot?
Well, I said we needed some sparks. He was just replying to me.
Oh, okay. I suppose, okay. Well, all right. I guess...
It was done with humor. I did not take it personally at all. We have another caller over.
I've been married for 25 years. I've been told that on many occasions, so it's okay, right? Get in line if you're really serious. No, I'm just kidding. All kidding aside, we do have another caller. It's Chad.
And I'm opening your mic, Chad. I was a little slow.
Oh,
sorry about that.
Let's see. I get back. Hello?
Yep,
am
you're
on.
On.
How you doing, Chad?
Okay. Hi. I didn't hear the beginning of the call because I was still on the call with the conference call with Eric and everybody earlier, so I don't know exactly what you guys have been talking about, but it appears that you are talking about jobs, and I think we have a really serious problem here in America. Obviously, nobody's talking about jobs, or at least not right now they aren't, but a lot of people are losing their jobs, and we all know that, and I heard that little brief thing about Walmart and things like that, and you know, when you're not sure where your money's coming, you're not sure if you have a job. I have a friend who just lost her job. She and another 40 people, all in one fell swoop on Friday, got called in and said goodbye, and this was from MetLife. So, big companies losing lots of people really fast, and even though they were doing well, they're out there looking for jobs and sending out a gazillion resumes and having interviews. And just getting, nothing back. I think that we keep hearing things like we want to have a national conversation about this and that. I don't exactly know where we have these conversations. Or maybe we have them on Blog Talk Radio. That's where we have the conversations. But I think that I read a book last year called The Great Stagnation by Tyler Cowen. It was talking about the fact that America is basically picked all our low-hanging fruit. And we don't need all the things we needed before. We've all got TVs and washing machines, and so the middle class has sort of bought everything they need to buy. And if we don't have money going into the economy and people making money so they can keep putting in the economy and people coming up, what are we going to do? I think we have so many strange situations in America where we advocate for the individual completely, and yet at the same time we live in communities that do not communicate. it's so odd to me. I'm self-employed, and I'm on the road every day, and I go to people's homes and fix their furniture, and that's what I do for a living. And I go into communities. People want to live in gated communities. They want to live in houses that look exactly the same, and the only thing about them that you can tell they're different is the number on the door, which is often hard to find. There is no consistency about where they put the numbers, so that can be confusing for me. But we, on one hand, we're very conformist, and on the other hand, whenever we feel our rights are threatened or we're getting taxes, we're all of a sudden individuals. And I think we have this constant flip-flop between trying to figure out who we are. And so I think that when the jobs go, wherever they go, and the small business, I'm a small business owner in a sense, although it's just me, myself, and I, but I try to support like local hardware stores and stuff like that are becoming few and far between, that are cutting the pays of their workers just to keep them employed. I shop at a paint store, and they've lowered everybody's wages so they could all keep their jobs. people are not painting their houses, or they're doing it themselves thanks to Home Depot and stuff like that. So we've really created a real mess, I think, here. And one thing I've been meaning to do for a long time, and I keep talking about it, I think that's all I'll probably ever do about it, is how many jobs my iPhone has eliminated. My iPhone does more for me than almost any assistant than I could ever imagine having. And so, the expression, there's an app for that. Well, there's an app for that ... person that could have had that job doing that thing.
Technological advances, you take that all the way back to obviously the manufacturing, right, the heart of what is missing in the United States these days as far as sustained growth and sustainability in our economy. Right, and people always say, well, what about robots? Why did we let robots go into manufacturing plants? And the whole group, if you remember going back, I'm not exactly sure, Chad, how old you are, but I'm 51, and I remember being in class in the third grade and watching the little Disney black and white movie about how in the year 2000 we'll all be driving flying cars that are built by robots, and we'll only be working 2 hours a day, and life will be wonderful, right? But what happens is the opposite. It's in a bad economy when things go south. You look at all the things that have built into this, right? So first of all, things go south. Then what happens? The crash happens, and everybody's 401k tanks. And so now people that are supposed to be retiring in their mid-60s have to keep working because they don't have enough for retirement anymore, right? Because why? Because Wall Street perpetrated this mass robbery on all of us, robbed us once, took all of our money, and then basically in taxes in 2009 took it again in the form of a bailout. We paid them twice, and now people have to keep working. So now we've got a glut of employment, right, or employees. And now the young kids can't get jobs, or if they can get jobs, they're doing it at the expense of a guy who's in his 50s who's still trying to figure out how to retire. Now he gets the boot. They bring in the kid at half the price, and how is that guy in his 50s? He can't pay his mortgage anymore. So it's all this downward spiral that we've seen, and how do we stop it and reverse it and without investing serious dollars into the economy?
I think I have a totally, like, way out of the fringe solution for all of this.
Okay.
So this is the fringe check. But, Iceland just said, screw the banks. We're not going to pay them. Screw the banks. Because the people who created all of this mess are the banks.
Right.
And we're running around trying to figure out, solve all these problems so we can give the banks the money.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that we really need to live? We need shelter.
Food.
We need food.
Food and shelter. Right.
And who really cares if your Visa bill is paid? If you don't, if you're not using it to try and buy something.
Yeah, that's the problem with that. When Dan asked how old it is, I'm going to be 66 in like 5 days. I'm getting up there and thinking about retirement and at the same time saying impossible. Retirement will be a box for me when it's time. But, screw the banks. You think you're going to step forward and make, they have these things every time tax season rolls around and people say, put your money in an escrow account and don't pay the taxes and use the protest. And, you can do that, but you'll be in jail.
I didn't say the government. I said the banks.
I know the banks.
But Debbie Lynn, if I may, are you telling me you can see the line between the two? Are you telling me you could see a line between the banks and the government at this point in time?
That's
good
true.
Point, Dan. Good point.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's We're talking about allies here. The banks and the government are in bed together. They seem to share the same pillow.
And that's true. And in Iceland, they did not. But here they seem to,
In
Iceland,
it
was let the banks fail. Forget those guys. Yeah, absolutely. Here, not so much. Here, it's now we're going to pay you, and we're going to pay your bonuses. Todd, you brought something up, and I've been reading as I do a lot of this stuff, and I came across this interesting thing called the social contract. And I said, I've heard that term used a lot, but there was actually a treatise written by a French guy back in the 1700s, and this is how it's reduced down to this exact thing. right? The social contract can be reduced down to this. Each of us puts his person and all his power, or her power, obviously, this sexist back in the 1700s in France, his or her power in common under the supreme direction of the general will. And in body, we receive each member as an indivisible part of the whole. Right? We trust our neighbors and everybody in our society, but we also trust that society is going to take care of us and we are going to be remembered. And I think the bottom line that we're facing today is that everybody wants the whole to do what's best for them, but they're not so much into doing what's best for the whole. And I think that's what you bring up, and we've had several callers bring it up. Why don't go to Walmart. Go to the local hardware store. Don't go to Home Depot. Go, and to me, it's a matter of if you can afford it. Now, I thank God I still do well. I can afford to go to the local hardware store, and, I know I want to pay 10 or 15% more. I'm glad. I'm happy to do it.
Right.
It's the people that are convinced that they can't do without in something that actually Joseph Stiglitz calls – he said, trickle-down economics doesn't work, but trickle-up spending works every time. And what he meant by that is people that have less look at what the people that have more are, and they want to spend exactly like them.
Right.
And we're not good in the United States of saying, no, I can live without that. No, I can live without that.
Yeah, no, we live – I mean, I've lived abroad. My wife is Portuguese, and I lived in Portugal for a while, and I traveled Europe when I was a young man and stuff like that. And my wife's heard me say this many times, but and in my opinion, that nobody in the world lives like we do. And unless you've been in another country, almost any other country, you don't realize how incredibly lucky we are to live with all the creature comforts we have. And at the same time, I think we're such an entitled society. Statistically, they come out with, traffic accidents caused by texting or not using hands-free cell phone. And I'm on a major highway here in New Jersey every day, and everybody's on their cell phone and they've got it to their ear. They're not hands-free. At least they're not hands-free. And I thought of simple laws, like if you're going to use your phone, then you have to stay in the slow lane. Because you shouldn't be in the fast lane because you're not paying attention. And you think it'd be a simple law and they'd make you get pulled over for that. You never get pulled over for any of the things. We've got the laws on the books, but you can't use your cell phone in your car, but they can't stop you for that. You have to have a taillight out too in order for them to stop you for the taillight, and then you get the ticket for this cell phone as well. But we all feel very much entitled. No, I can drive with my cell phone even though I know that idiot that just cut me off can't. And so we don't buy into statistics unless it works for our cause or if we're not a cell phone user or whatever. And it's what you had said about the collective and things. We think we are a part of a community until it comes right at us. And then we're like, well, no, I didn't mean me. I meant you, And I think we're spoiled rotten is what we are. We really are spoiled.
Let me ask you this, Chad. How can we build a citizenry of responsible consumers, right? Because let's face it, in the end, it's always in the hand of the consumer. You don't like the media, turn the channel off. That's fine. It's simple. They'll go away, right? It's always in the hands of the consumer in the end. You don't like who's in Washington? Who did you vote for last time? Because you put people there. If you don't like them, recall them and put somebody else there. It's always in the hands. So how do we build a responsible consumer base who will make those choices that will help put Americans back to work?
Well, I don't think we can do it because I think we've designed and I don't know who the we is or they, I don't know who the they is, but we and they have designed communities that keep us isolated. And so I'm sitting here in my office, in my messy office with my computers and stuff and talking to you. I'm not sitting in a coffee house. I'm not in a church. I'm not in a grange. I'm not in any social club having this dialogue with 10 other people. I'm talking to you, and although a bunch of people may be listening to this, I'm still anonymous. And so I can say I voted for Obama when I actually voted for Romney. I can say any of those things because it doesn't mean anything because there's no proof of it. There's no, I'm not accountable for anything I say because I do it in isolation. And we are all isolated. The way we live, I live in the burbs, if you will. I live and happen to live in a red county or red township in a county. And we don't, most, I don't go to church. I don't belong. I do belong to some organizations, but they are dwindling. I just had a conversation with the president of one of the clubs that I belong to, and we're trying to figure out how do we get people to engage again. We used to have 80 members. Now we're down to 20. And even the 20, when you go to do a presentation or something, you just get these blank stares. We don't know how to be involved with each other as a community anymore. We only know how to, I mean, I was at the movie. I went to see Silver Lining Playbook over the weekend. And by the way, it's an extraordinarily good movie, and I recommend it to any everybody. But we went to a theater that used to be two movies, and they've now chopped it up into six movies. And we know why, because you can't fill them, because now everybody has 55-inch TV screens and Netflix and Amazon and DVDs, and we don't have to go anywhere, and we don't have to engage with people anymore. And we've designed, it's been done by design, not a design that we really knew we were participating in, but we did participate in it because we accepted it. And now, unless you live in a city, you don't even know your neighbors. There's no reason to know your neighbors because if you have to go to the store, you don't walk there. You jump in a car and you drive there by yourself. So you don't, you know, you might be the kind of person that recognizes a Ford or a Honda and you can wait, you know, flash your lights to somebody. But for the most part, we don't see anybody because we don't live that way anymore. And I think as long as we continue to live this way, it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And we're going to only have things like the coffee party that and this faceless voice that we talk to like now and you know, to keep us human. But
I'm scared now, John. I want to find a tall building and jump off of it now. But here's the thing. I truly believe that there are so many people like you, and I'm going to throw a number out. I believe there's at least 81 million people like you who have so lost hope, so given up, they just don't think they can affect change. Well, hold on. I'm saying, but they've gone beyond you. They quit voting. 81 million eligible voters in this country did not vote enough to take any one single third-party candidate and elect them in a landslide. So we need to reengage. So I think that's the coffee party's mission. We've got to reengage.
And that's the voting thing you brought up. I have a solution for voting, a perfect solution, and I know it never flies, even though it's a perfect solution. When I lived in Portugal, Portugal has mandatory voting. You have to vote. However, you can vote no. You can vote. Maybe you've even heard it on the foreign news, BBC. You'll get a vote of no confidence. So if you go to every candidate that's on the ballot, as long as there's a line under every candidate saying no confidence, I have no confidence in any of the people running or any of the issues on there. So you have to vote. You have to go to the polls. You have to cast the ballot. But you can vote no confidence. And by that, when the news reports at midnight or whatever, it's 2 in the morning on election night, they can say that, you know, everybody voted, and so-and-so got 20%, and so-and-so got 30%, and 50% voted no confidence. And if the public has no confidence in the people that they're running for office, then you just have to do a do-over. You have to do a do-over.
That's parliamentary. And believe me, Chad, I got that one covered. You ready? So we can never do it with the stick in this country, but I think we could do it with the carrot. How about you vote, you get a $1,000 tax credit.
Ooh, I like that. I like that.
I'll pay you to vote. I'll give you a $1,000 tax credit if you vote.
Okay. Is that like Citizen United? There's a super PAC that'll give you the $1,000. What's a big deal? I can do it easily. You know, if 81 million didn't vote, and they could be paid by, I mean, the super PAC spend that kind of money in one season. So that's $1,000 is a good idea.
Just a thought. DL, you got any thoughts on how we can increase voter participation?
Yeah, well, actually, I was going back. I love your ideas that you're coming up with on giving the tax credit for voting. And of course, mm-hmm. they're going to have the whole big, you know, conversation about how to actually make sure people are voting so that they're not cheating on their taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to go back real quick to the electronic, you guys are calling it electronic isolation.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to point out that it's also additional connection, because there are people who are connecting through electronics that would not otherwise be able to connect with people outside of their outside of the bubble that they have to live in, people who have been shut in, that are now able to connect outside of where they live that they would not otherwise be able to connect. And so it's additional connection and not just isolation. And so and perhaps it's often connection in a different way than we have been accustomed to in the past with mm-hmm. face-to-face meetings. And I think depending on how we decide to embrace it or demonize it is going to really determine, you know, what results we get from it. Because whether we like it or not, it's here and it's coming, and especially the younger generation, they're all about electronic communication.
Yeah. Personally, I don't think it's about how you communicate. I think it's about what you communicate about.
Yep.
I think people
yep.
are motivated by subject matter. Right, you put up gun control, oh boy,
yep.
people are going to connect. They're going to connect on one, two sides of the fence, but they're going to connect, right? So
yeah.
if you put up right. the, I think to me, and this is the unfortunate thing, and this is the one I always wrestle with, because I know the coffee party is about civility. I signed the civility pledge. I always want to be civil. But the fact of the matter is that in the last 50 years, you know, 100 years of this country's history, the only time we've ever really come together as a nation is to bond against a common enemy. And I would
right.
so not
right.
want to make Wall Street or big business or big money or whoever you want to demonize, put that face of the devil on, right, and say we have
right.
to bond against these people because they are trying to ruin us or they are ruining us. But
right.
I sometimes don't see any other way to make that galvanization happen.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. We do seem to put up these images of, you know, the terrorists and or whatever we're going to call them, and we need somebody to hate. And I think for all the good in America, and I do believe there's just I firmly believe that we have the best of the world and we have the worst of the world at the same time. And the worst is getting really bad. But, I mean, I just go to your point a little bit about the gun thing. It strikes me, and I'm not a gun owner, but I have friends who are, and never felt threatened by them or anything. But I think that, you know, we have, on the one hand, in terms of following the news, we have the NDAA bill, and on the one hand, we have the, you know, stop guns. And I have to say that I think there is an argument, not for the militia so much, but if our government can come and arrest me and throw away the key, you know, it might feel good to feel like Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid for a moment, you know, just to at least have a fighting chance of dying in my own home instead of dying in some prison somewhere. I mean, we really have these things going across purposes a lot. And, of course, and don't get me wrong, obviously the Newtown thing was a horrific tragedy, but we also have a very broken young man who perpetrated this act. And to demonize every gun owner with the same breath is ludicrous.
Oh yeah, no, there's no doubt. And of course, now you've taken us back. We've done a time warp. We've gone back in time a week, and we've gotten back to last week's schedule. But you're right, because I think you've hit the nail on the head in that you talk about bread and circus and how, you know, the government with very much the help of the media, make sure that we don't talk about these important things like putting people back to work. I mean, they've had us embroiled in battles over guns and with NDAA and FISA, mm-hmm. our civil liberties and this, that, or everything. And, yeah, anything to get us fighting amongst ourselves so that we take our eyes off the prize, which is, hey, you people have been really rogering us for 30 years, and we want it back. We've got to
right.
take it back. So, yeah. So Chad, as always, absolute pleasure talking to you. We've we're only intended to go an hour tonight, but as usual, we've gone over. No. It's always a pleasure. So I don't know if we've got Linda and Bob on. I can't believe Bob Trotter is sitting here and not wanting to get in on this conversation. Bob, we need you. I mean, see, he's sitting at home, but
you turned the mute off.
He hasn't pressed one.
Oh, he just needed to.
There he goes. I knew I could get him.
We know your phone number, Bob, so I just type your name in when you call in.
Let's open up Bob's mic and get a closing thought for the night, and then we'll call it.
Okay. Oh. That's
there
right.
You go, Bob. You are on the air.
No, I just agree with everything that's been said tonight. You guys have covered it beautifully. There's a major problem out there with the way corporations are functioning, and it needs to be changed. And I'll leave it all to you guys to finish up. But I agree with everything that's been said tonight. Absolutely.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob. So since nobody's actually laid out the Dan plan, Dan's now, because I, as the host, I always feel like I want to elicit everybody else's reactions and ideas first before I put mine out there. But I see it as very simple. I see it as it is time for us to force the wealthy and all of those people who have been the recipients of trickle-down economics and all those policies and deregulation and tax breaks, blah, 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 that we all know that they've had. It's time we have to force their hand. We absolutely have to get progressive in our tax system. We have to tax the wealthy and the job creators who, frankly, haven't been creating jobs. And we have to take that money and we have to put it in a pool. And, Bob, I know you're big about local spending. I love that. Because one of the things I think that could really stimulate our economy is urban renewal. I lived in Portland, Oregon, and what they have done to this city, and I've studied it since I got here a year and a half ago, what they did, what this city was in 1980 and what this city is now, what a difference. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But because the local people and the local politicians said we're going to invest, and what they've done here is nothing for the miraculous, but there's no reason it can't be done everywhere.
Right.
We need,
good point.
Yeah. It's infrastructure investments, but right. I'm sorry, Bob. I'm gonna let you talk because I know you're big.
Giving the money to the local guys,
right? That's one of your big things, right? Right. Give the money to the local guys. Get it out of the graft of the public or the federal guys.
That's right. The tax plan that Obama put in effect was like a symbolic more than real. It raised rates 4% on the marginal rates, which is a joke. And the big corporation got the bail, as you pointed out, they got the bailouts on the fiscal cliff settlement. All the big corporations got their share, and that's the reason why it passed. So they made out like bandits again.
And let me ask you this question, Bob, because here's a quiz for Bob. Who is the company that's always demonized as the hugest company, the largest company in the world that doesn't pay taxes?
Well, Exxon. Well, GE, but Exxon, I think.
GE. Let's go with GE. Good job, GE.
Okay.
Do you know that Jeffrey Immelt, GE CEO, was on President Obama's jobs committee? How to create jobs. He turned to a guy who hasn't paid a dime of taxes from a corporate standpoint in 4 years and said, hey, you must know how to create jobs. As a matter of fact.
But Dan, it gets better than that. He actually has 90, I think it's 90 employees that actually fill one entire floor of the GE building that do nothing but figure out how to keep GE from paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He employs 90 people to do that.
Please,
GE
Mr. Mouse, tell me how to gut the cheese.
Has been the friend of every president since Richard Nixon, and since Reagan, they haven't paid a penny of taxes.
Yeah.
Consistently,
well,
no matter who the president, you know. It's not politics, it's money.
There were 17 people on that committee, and
yeah.
8 of them were CEOs of Fortune 500 companies.
Of
the
course.
Same people that have bankrupted us, that have taken their money, have offshore jobs, have offshore assets, hidden them and protected them to make sure that they don't pay taxes. And these are the eight guys, these are eight of the 17 people he appoints to his jobs creation committee.
Mm-hmm.
And we wonder why we're not getting anywhere.
Well, he did. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Debbie Lynn.
I was just going to say, wait, did he specify he wanted the jobs created in the U.S.?
Well, so guys, you laugh about that, but this is just the girl, Christiane, well, what's her name, that wrote The Plutocracy. You know, we are in a global economy now, and those jobs are not coming back. I mean, this is, we are where we are.
Well, of course, they could always come back, but the political will isn't there to bring them back. The place where we can, I think, be productive is high-tech manufacturing, I think.
Well, yeah, but I don't, I mean, what we could, I have a customer right now his wife's a designer and he's a salesman, and they have a furniture company, and all their furniture is made in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But, and there was an article in I can't remember if it was the Times or something, there was an article last week or on Sunday or something like that about a firm in San Diego that's making something in their factory, you know, across the border in Tijuana. And, you know, we share borders with other countries, you know. I'm really not opposed to that if it allows an entrepreneur to be an entrepreneur and get, you know, labor done
mm-hmm.
someplace else. But there was an article, there was a show today on NPR, on the radio about this company that makes the blow dryers in the washrooms for drying your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And the manufacturer is up in Massachusetts someplace, I think, and they put together, it's all 40 American workers putting everything together, but the guts of the machine that actually blows the hot air
mm-hmm.
is made in Asia. And, you know, so
yeah.
we've got, you know, just-in-time manufacturing, and we've got, you know, your product has to be marketable. You have
mm-hmm.
to be able to sell it, and if you have to, you have to watch the cost. And now that we have a global economy, and we can have China, Foxconn, Mexico, whatever, Bangladesh, making this stuff, you know, I don't think there's anything we can buy anymore that is completely American, unless it's the woods, the trees that got knocked down in Sandy. You know, we
mm-hmm.
can buy them, but. No, these are the serious conversations that we need to have. That we've,
mm-hmm.
you know, we can't go back. We have to go with
what we got now
and try to figure out what to do. I mean, right where you live, Robert, I thought for a long time. I travel 78, and you're familiar with 78.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got all these Pennsylvania cars coming to New Jersey on their way to work. And I know in the Lehigh Valley where you live, there's, you know, that's where everybody lives. Why can't they take a place like Easton and Bethlehem and take all these factories that are abandoned and stuff and put, you know, super fast DSL lines
mm-hmm.
in there and make mobile offices for all these people that work with the caucus down here that can stay out where they live and commute by internet. And they can stay in their communities and shop in their communities and stuff and don't have to drive all the way down here to New York City to do a work job that you can do in front of a terminal. And so put the investment into these abandoned Ingersoll Rand, whatever those
mm-hmm.
buildings out there,
mm-hmm.
and put infrastructure there so that people can at least be local. Again, what I was talking about before about the communities and things like that, everybody talks about living in the communities. The only people who live in communities are the school children who go to school in the community they live, because the parents only see the community at night when everything's dark. They don't live there. They don't shop. The kids are the only ones that are actually in the community. But we can change that. We could change that. And take advantage of the internet that we have. And that most of the people I know, I mean, not myself, but most of the people I know basically sit behind a computer all day long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they sit in offices all day long. They're on the phone all day long.
I sit at a computer all day long doing coffee party work.
Exactly.
Hey, John.
Right.
I don't get paid, you know, I don't get paid the big bucks.
I don't work for GE.
Right.
I don't know. All right. John, again, always love the passion, love the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually what we're trying to get to. I think we've got a ton of ideas. Robert, as always, I don't know, any finishing thoughts, if you will?
Yes. John, I need you to co-host a show with my computer expert, a Ustream TV show out here on a Sunday night.
Okay, well, I'll think about it. I'm really busy.
He's going on vacation. He's going away. He's going away in March. And I can't handle it by myself.
Maybe I can help you out. Maybe I can help you out, Mark. As long as there's not snow on the ground.
I love this. We're scheduling Coffee Party TV on your radio show, Dan.
Hey, you know what? It's a beauty. Bob, as always, thank you. Tamara, I see you've been holding on. I know you've been awful quiet. Are you, any final remarks or words for us of wisdom?
Am I still on the call?
You are still on it. We've never shut your mic. We were waiting for you to jump
very
in and tell these guys and tell these guys where they were wrong.
Wow. I'm glad I didn't belch or anything. I thought you muted me.
No worries. As a matter of fact, if you have nothing more to say, I will mute you now, and you'll hear that there will be a nice little word that will say, muted, and then you'll know that's how you know you're muted. No, but really, if you have anything else.
Yeah, it's a great show. I really enjoyed the show tonight and the one I listened to earlier, that your last show. So thank you.
I am so glad. Thank you very much. And come back again every Monday and tune into the other radio shows. I think there's a lot of good energy here, a lot of good ideas. I mean, and that's really what I want this show to focus on. I want this show not just to be about people calling up and complaining about everybody else or everything or everyone, but let's get solutions. Let's find solutions, and let's drive those solutions, be it writing letters to our representatives and our senators and the White House, or, you know, showing up at protests or, you know, local community grassroots movements. I can tell you right now we're involved with some other like-minded groups, Business Ethics Network, that are one of the big things. We're coming into shareholders meeting seasons. And one of the things that they're organizing, the Business Ethics Network is organizing, are protests that show up at these corporations and where they're doing these stockholder meetings, and to say, tell your company no more donating to PACs, no more donating to politicians unless we approve it first, because we don't like the way you're spending our money. And Debbie Lynn, you sound like you want to chime right in on that one.
Well, I just, it's one of the things is that I would love to have done as a former shareholder of a couple of companies, because they were spending PAC money that I certainly would not have approved. So I hope for all of those Coffee Party listeners out there that do still own stock in the stock market, you might take a look at where your investments are spending their PAC money.
Absolutely. Thank you. Any other last thoughts you want to have before we sign off?
Just a reminder that about Coffee Party being a member sponsored only. We don't have any corporate sponsors or corporate donors, and it's all about you. And that's part of why we love doing what we do.
And absolutely.
CoffeePartyUSA.com is the place to make a contribution, or you can tag me offline, and I'll give you a mailing address.
Excellent. Thanks, you, DL. As always, this is Dan Aronson. Located this evening from the beautiful, balmy, where am I? Punta Gorda, Florida. But I will be back suffering with you, DL, for the rest of the winter very soon. So say hi to Portland for me, have a microbrew, and we will see everybody next week here at Press One for Democracy.